Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Back in the days when tough-on-crime laws were being hammered into place, mandatory minimums, three-strikes legislation, truth in sentencing, no one worried much about the money. After all, crime was on the rise. Drug dealers were clamoring over the fences of the school playgrounds. It was no time to be soft, no time to fret over the cost of incarceration. The safety of the nation's children was at stake. But times have changed. Crime rates are now way down, and with all those inmates locked up, prison costs are now way up, in some states double, even triple what they were a few years ago. This might be a fine state of affairs, except that many state budgets are now in the red, and prisons are an expensive proposition. Some states are throwing open the gates and releasing inmates early. Kentucky's governor sent 500 of them home late last month. Elsewhere around the nation, prisons are being closed, and mandatory minimum sentencing laws are being repealed. Connection listeners, is this any way to manage a justice system? There's no question the fiscal crisis in the states is changing the way America deals with criminals. Question is, are the right changes being made? Does dollar and cents thinking produce a more rational sentencing policy, or is it just irresponsible? Our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us today, Nick Turner. He's director of national programs at the Vera Institute of Justice. That's a nonprofit group in New York City that consults with states on sentencing policy. Welcome to The Connection, Nick.
Thank you. Good morning.
And also joining us, Jeff Sauter. He's a prosecutor in Eaton County, Michigan, former president of the State Prosecuting Attorneys Association. And Jeff's joining us from the WKAR studios in East Lansing, Michigan. Good morning, Jeff.
Morning.
Let me start with you, if I can. How serious is the prison money problem in Michigan?
Well, I would say it is serious, as it is in a number of other states that you've described. So, we're looking at a problem.
I mean, I noted that it was your outgoing governor on Christmas Day who repealed the mandatory minimum laws. Was in your view, was that a good thing to do?
Well, actually, that was something our association supported, with the intro, I think that it's important that we carefully separate which types of legislative actions have taken place lately, or which types of executive actions, as which ones have been an attempt at a quick fix versus the one that I would say was a deliberative change in the law. The change in mandatory minimums in Michigan, the elimination of those, was one I would say was in that deliberative process, and one that our association participated in. We worked on that bill.
Would it be fair to say then that you regard the release of the 500 in Kentucky as a more irrational sort of knee-jerk response to the problem?
Yes. That to me is a problem. That's an attempt at a quick fix, and I think there are a number of problems with that type of approach.
Well, it's coming, or it may be coming in Michigan, right?
There are some that are proposing that we have early release of prisoners in Michigan, yes.
And if it is done in a way where someone sits and says, all right, this person should be allowed out early, 3 months, this person maybe 6 months, what's wrong with it as a money-saving device?
I looked at it purely as a money-saving device. I suppose there's nothing wrong with it. But I think that's a poor way to establish corrections policy. There's no doubt there's a money problem, and I'm not here to argue that there isn't. I just think that we have to look elsewhere in terms of saving money, at least in terms of a quick fix like an early release. The initial problem is it violates the trust between the government and its people. This is the operation of a criminal justice system is one of the few essential obligations of government. And the criminal justice system itself is a very methodical and regulated process where we have checks and balances of different branches of government who have proceeded to prosecute and then a judge sentenced this individual. And then to all of a sudden have this quick fix where we have changed that process, the decision as to how much punishment that person should get just to save some bucks, I think that's wrong, because that alters the basis on which our citizens view the system, because it is no longer predictable, not only to the people in the system, but to those who pay for it and who depend on it.
Now, Jeff, you and the other prosecutors worked fairly hard on getting truth in sentencing passed in Michigan. Am I right about that?
We did. We saw that as a culmination of establishing rights for victims in Michigan.
And so when we're talking about the possibility or the likelihood of early release, you're saying that in many ways breaks the promise of that's made in truth in sentencing?
Absolutely. Truth in sentencing is a principle that we think brings integrity to the criminal justice system, because it's a requirement that the prisoner sentenced to prison must serve 100% of the minimum sentence in a secure facility. Very simple, very predictable, very understandable by everyone in the system and those who depend on it. To suddenly say that we can afford less than truth in our system is wrong. Again, it breaks that bond. It breaks the trust that we have between government and its citizens. And we return to a system that Michigan experienced in the 90s where no one understood what a sentence meant. We had early releases of prisoners, and we had the consequences of those early releases. And some of those consequences were not just chaotic, they were dangerous.
Let's bring Nick Turner in here and get a sense, Nick, from you, if we can, of how the picture looks across the country. We see in daily newspaper stories, news from Kentucky, news from Michigan, news from Louisiana, from Alabama. What's the overall picture look like?
Well, the overall picture is similar to what Jeff described in Michigan. If you look across the country, about 43 of 50 states right now are facing budget deficits in the current year, so they're looking for savings. And if you then take the conversation to the criminal justice system, there are states like Kentucky that are considering mass commutations, early release. And then there are also a set of states that are looking at closing down programs in prison that relate to drug treatment or education. And then you have another set of states that are still trying to figure out exactly what to do around sentencing policy and to engage in some of the more deliberative processes that Jeff mentioned to actually figure out who should be in prison, make judgments about that up front through a legislated process that's out in the open. So there's a wide variety of reactions to
what you're in effect doing is underlining what Jeff was saying, that we need to make sure that we draw a distinction between the policies that are being changed because those changes are the right thing to do and those policies that are being put in place because people are panicking about a lack of money.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I think to characterize the responses that you're seeing in the states as functions of panic and desperation and then to characterize it as the reactions to be ones like the Kentucky governor's, mm-hmm. and say that that's what's happening all across the country is wrong. There are a range of reactions, some of them better than others.
But Nick, how did we ever get to a situation where that kind of panicked reaction had to take place? What happened? How do we get here?
Well, you summed it up pretty nicely, actually, in your introduction. We, for the past 10 or 15 years, have implemented a variety of tough on crime policies and have been able to do that without paying much attention to fiscal impact. I mean, certainly if you look at the 90s, all states around the country were building up reserves of cash. They couldn't figure out how to spend it fast enough. Budgets were growing, and so you could implement a set of policies and it would have a huge impact on corrections budgets, and it didn't matter because it could be paid for, and you could also pay for education reform and increases in Medicaid and all the like. What we see now, obviously, and everyone knows this, is that it's a very different economic picture, and so you no longer have the resources to support policy. And so that's creating a set of reactions. You had raised a question earlier about whether paying attention to money in terms of within the context of criminal justice policy and building a system is irresponsible. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's the case. I think it actually is responsible. I think that in lots of other policy settings, we pay attention to the costs of our various interventions. We didn't do that for a long time, and now that's coming back to haunt us. And because we didn't do it for a long time, and because it seems new, it's creating a perhaps more. It's being characterized in a way that makes people worry, because we've never had to worry about the money before, at least not in the past 10 years, which is about the attention span for most people.
I'd like to interpose on that, because I'm not certain I agree entirely with that concept that for the past 10 years or so that no one paid attention to the cost. I don't agree entirely. I think that there was also a reaction to previous policy and the results of those policies, and a considered judgment that we needed to expand prison space in America in almost all states. And that was a deliberate decision. And obviously, I think the legislatures were well aware of the cost of building those. And I specifically want to point out the example here in Michigan, if I can, of truth in sentencing, where I think it's flat wrong to say that no one worried about the cost of implementing that proposal, if I could.
Let me ask you, Jeff, though, to give us a citizen's perspective here of something like early release, because it is being talked about, it is being contemplated by some state legislatures. We look at people who are released early from prison all the time through time off for good behavior, through parole. If someone is released 3 or 6 months early through an early release program as a cost saving, why is that any more dangerous or threatening to society?
Well, I do think it represents a public safety risk, but it also, if we only look at the public safety risk, we ignore the other factors that went into the determination of the length of the sentence, such as the deterrence of others and punishment of that offender. That's three of the four appropriate considerations that most judges use in establishing the length of the sentence. The fourth would be the potential for rehabilitation of that offender. But you asked me for the citizens' perception. I think the citizens' perception is also what drove the expansion of prisons in America, the reaction to those early releases. We had situations in Michigan, I'll give you an example, in the early 90s, I think 1992, our Department of Corrections hosted a conference. I think it was in two sites in Michigan. I attended one of them. It was standing room only, experienced judges, prosecutors, probation agents. The title of the conference: What a Sentence Really Means. No one understood. No one knew what a sentence meant in Michigan. It was such a mess. And we had people being released from prison who were committing new crimes. And so the citizen reaction to that was, this is unacceptable.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. When you look at what's happening in the prisons today, do you consider it acceptable or unacceptable? We're talking about cost reduction measures. Those are some things the states can't avoid. Do you favor early release programs, the dropping of mandatory minimum sentences? Our telephone number, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Today, an issue that has been very close to the headlines for the past month, and that is how states are coping with their budget crisis by reevaluating the amount of money they're spending on their prison systems. We read about prisons closing and prisoners being released early, drug sentences being reduced, drug-related sentences being reduced. And with me on the program to talk about this today, Jeff Sauter. He's Eaton County Prosecutor in Michigan, and joining us from East Lansing, Michigan. Also, Nick Turner's with us. He's Director of National Programs at the Vera Institute of Justice. That's an organization that works with governments on sentencing reform and other criminal justice issues. He's in New York. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'll start in Newton, Massachusetts, and Mike's calling in. Hello, Mike.
Hello, thanks for taking the call. And I just want to identify myself as a lawyer who originally started out working for the Department of Correction and the Parole Board,
Okay. Moved
on to being a public defender, and I'm now work for a nonprofit where I monitor mental health services in prisoners, in prisons, in county and state prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that the reason why we have the problems we do in our correctional system is because of the what I would consider to be brain-dead policies of prosecutor-driven incarceration plans that have failed to protect the public safety. The reason why...
Be more specific. Give me an example of what you're talking about.
Well, an example is drug sentences. Right now, in my state, Superior Court state judges never, ever, ever see kingpins in their courts. They only see little people, mules, and people who are dealing for their own support. And these people are subject to sentences that breaks up families. And as any policeman knows, taking a drug dealer off the street doesn't do anything for public safety. It merely creates a job opening after which more drug dealers fight it out with each other. Drug sentences and the kind of people who are subjected to those kind of sentences that disables them from being able to be autonomous when they get out are the bane of the existence of the criminal justice system.
Okay, Mike, if that was then what about now? Should those people be among those considered for early release? What's the remedy at this point now that the attention of the legislators is at least caught by the dollar signs?
The remedy is community-based outpatient treatment for nonviolent drug prisoners. In Massachusetts, 2,000 of the 11,000 prisoners in the state prison system have nonviolent drug offenses as their lead offense. They cost us $36,000 a year to keep them inside with no programs to speak of and coming out with recidivism rates that are abysmal. For a net savings of $30,000 per person, we could put them in outpatient treatment, give them full psychotropic meds, professional clinical staffing, and a variety of care plans that would far more effectively reduce recidivism than simply sticking them away and locking them up and throwing away the key. We'll save enough money to both increase and improve the quality of programs in prisons and also reduce the recidivism rates by giving people who are nonviolent a chance to get treated and work their way through the system.
Just hang on a second here if you can, because I want to hear from Jeff Sutter in Michigan about whether or not prosecutors are, you know, going back, part of the problem here.
The prosecutor-driven policies. And I understand what Mike's talking about is sometimes we're perceived as the ones driving that. I don't think that's accurate. I think oftentimes we're the ones that just reflect the desire of the community. But and actually, I would agree with Mike that I think some of the policies, especially those that have overreactive mandatory sentences, three strikes, I think, is the best example. Is pretty much a brain-dead policy. I don't like it, and I'd go into more of that. But I going to the other side, I think there's a misconception created by people when, such as Mike's suggestion that our prisons are full of people who had just possessed drugs. We looked at that in Michigan when we were going through this process of repealing the mandatory minimum drug sentences, and we found that the number of prisoners who were in there solely for possessing drugs numbered in the hundreds, like a couple hundred, in a prison population of 48,000. Now, there are a lot of people in there who have drug problems, and I agree with Mike that I think that impacts on other crimes. But I don't think our prisons are full of people for simple drug possession.
Mike?
Now, you can make a decision, and I think legislatures have to, about drug dealers. And I think Mike espouse one opinion. But I think the typical one is that a lot of people in society consider drug dealers to have a direct impact on public safety.
Mike, let me just hear quickly from you, and then I want to go to Nick.
Well, I think that prosecutors are a vital resource, as are police officers, in dealing with community safety. I think that those resources should be marshaled against things that really mean something, which would be violent criminals. And I guess I take issue with the statistical information that he describes. I don't doubt that certain statistical studies were done, but it just beggars the imagination to think that we have more drug prisoners, listed drug prisoners in this country, and these are Justice Department statistics,
right,
in the United States, than there are all of criminals in the entire economic union, which has more people living in it than in the United States.
Nick Turner, Mike was going through a list of options that he's involved with, that he considers are better for prison. These are, that when he was going through the checklist, it was kind of like a checklist of the sort of things you're working on at the Vere Institute in the long term, aren't they?
To a certain extent, they are. I mean, if I can just back up for a quick sense,
sure.
For a quick moment. I mean, you know, you listen to Mike, and it makes a lot of sense on some level. You think about nonviolent offenders and drug offenders, and can we deal with them in a different way? Can we treat them if they have drug addictions? Why would we put them in a prison bed that costs $25,000, $30,000, $35,000, depending upon the state you're in? And that makes a lot of sense. But one of the critical problems with American criminal justice policy, it's a problem, but it's also a reality, and so you have to figure out how to make it work, is that it's politics. Prosecutors are elected, state legislators are elected, and criminal justice policy is driven by politics in this country, and it has been for 10, 15 years, for as long, and long before that, good politics to be tough on crime and not good politics to be soft on crime. And even in our discussion here, you see that we use those labels, which are as shorthand, and they've become completely accepted, and they blur any distinctions. So if you talk about trying to get treatment for nonviolent offenders, and you have a DA who supports that, or a legislator who supports it, an opponent can sweep in and very quickly say, "Look, you know, he's just trying to mollycoddle offenders. Is that what we want to do with our money?" And the conversation breaks down right there. So the it's important to remember the political context in which all of these conversations take place. And it's also important. I mean, one of the things that's troubling about the characterization of what's going on now as being desperate reactions to a fiscal crisis, and why should we even be talking about money when we're talking about criminal justice, is that it's not a sophisticated conversation. And we have to figure out how to do that. And so on some level, I mean, I think both Jeff and Mike are right. Jeff he's an elected official. He is responding to what he believes his voters tell him are important things. And Mike has to figure out a way to make elected officials be able to talk about the issues and to be able to advance the issues that he's discussing in a way that doesn't hurt them.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Mike, thank you for your call. Next to Raleigh, North Carolina, Luke's calling in. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Dick.
How are you?
I'm feeling a little redundant, actually, after hearing what Mike just had to say. Enjoying our conversation. Right now, I'm a young professional here in Raleigh. And 6 years ago, I was serving a mandatory sentence under North Carolina's felony drug statutes. And I think what the real crux of the problem is, and, you know, what we're really talking about is the efficacy of the Department of Correction in the first place.
Ask you a couple of questions about your own situation, Luke. Did you serve your whole sentence?
I did. Yes, sir. There were new guidelines, I guess, enacted right before my sentencing that I was, subject to. So I did, and the sentence was not inappropriate, I don't think, but for many cases other than myself, they certainly were.
No, I know that North Carolina is one of the states that set up a fairly elaborate charter to, in a simulation model, trying to figure out what the best plan is. But from your perspective, Luke, as someone who served a full sentence, when the states say, we got to save a little bit of money, maybe we should just let 500 people out of prison. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, of course, I have my family lives in this community, and I care about the safety of my state and its people. But again, at the same time, we don't want to let people that are unfit to live in society out early. But the real problem that I just wanted to call a voice is the Department of Corrections is, I think, in North Carolina and probably in many other states, not named correctly. I mean, there's very little correction that goes on, and if anything, it's a holding pen and a breeding ground for more antisocial and unproductive behavior.
So you're on board with what Mike was saying about looking for any sort of alternative for certain people charged with certain felony offenses?
Absolutely. And, I mean, the thing that comes to mind, and he elaborated on the drug situation, and that's a problem all over the nation. You know, and you can look at the victimless crime aspects, and certainly there are many victims. But are these people that can be rehabilitated without a lengthy prison sentence? And I would maintain they can. And hopefully the legislators, and ultimately it is politics that drives the legislation that outlines our laws, they're going to wake up and see. And probably with the younger batch, the boomers coming in, they're going to be a little bit more aware of the what drugs really are and what kind of problems they present for society.
Let me just swing over to Nick on this, Nick, because, I mean, as we talk about alternatives to prison, in one sense, what we're talking about is other programs that have other price tags. It's not, I mean, at a time when the states are trying to save money, can they do this sort of thing?
It's difficult to do when you're facing a budget crisis in the current year, and this might be more complicated than what you're asking for. I mean, it is true that treatment out in the community costs less than a prison bed does, but if you're trying to find immediate cost savings, which would mean needing to close down prisons or prison wings and deal with a bunch of fixed costs, a change in policy where you say direct nonviolent drug offenders that had previously been going to prison to community treatment doesn't provide you with immediate cost savings. And you have to pay for the treatment out in the community. Mm-hmm. So you will see savings in later years, but you won't often see it in the year
you just
where
need to
you're
talk,
trying to look for the savings.
Convince a politician who's got a 2 or 4 year term.
Right.
The long term
is
what counts here, right?
Right. A lot of people don't look beyond the fiscal year in which they're in. And so that's why you see reactions like the Kentucky governor's, because he had to save money today.
Right.
But Luke is absolutely right. And there are states that are trying to figure out how to make sentencing policy more sensible. And let me give you two examples. One, California 2 years ago, the voters passed an initiative by a 61% to 39% margin to provide mandatory treatment for all nonviolent drug offenders. And so that meant that the laws for the state changed. They could no longer be sent to prison. They had to be sent to mandatory treatment. And the voters also voted for, you know, there was a significant price tag. It was $100 million a year that would go to treatment out in the community. And the assumption was that it would actually save prison, it would save corrections costs in the long run. If you look at Kansas this year, the legislature is about to consider a similar policy where, and this is slightly different from what Jeff said. If you look at Kansas's a correction system, there are a lot of offenders in there who are nonviolent on simple drug possession charges. So they are the drug users that Mike from Newton talked about.
Let me just step in here if I can, because I want to see if we can squeak in one more call before we have to take a break. Thanks to Luke for calling, also to Raleigh, and Constance is on the line. Hi, Constance.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking the call. I'm an attorney. I don't have anything to do much with the criminal justice end of it. But my feeling about this is that, you know, you've got a budget crisis, but the basic premise is that this is a service to be protected by criminals. And, you know, and different kinds of sentencing and different kinds of programs are an entirely different thing. Once somebody goes through the criminal justice system, they most of the time have had multiple opportunities to reform themselves. And once they get into the Department of Corrections, it's a service that the government provides us, and it's also our responsibility to pay for it. And I think in the last 10 or 15 years, legislators and politicians have become so spineless and so gutless to raise taxes to pay for some of these basic services. You know, when the economy was good, they were afraid to raise taxes. And now that the economy is in a downturn, they're really in a pickle, I guess. But to me, to turn people out of prison early is just simply not the answer. It's kind of a downfall of our system. It's not the way, I don't think, to deal with this. I mean, we need to pay for these kinds of services.
My two guests are saying about public attitude? I mean, if people are feeling, Constance, that public safety may not be as high a priority as it might have been in the late 1980s, is it a mistake to say, well, let's repeal mandatory minimums or three strikes legislation?
Well, I think that's a larger question than I'm prepared to answer. It depends on what the crime rates are. But I do think, and I have some personal experience with petty drug use being responsible for crime. I have known some people and known of some people who have been addicted to crack and cocaine, and they, I don't care what kind of rehabilitation programs they went through, and they went through multiple ones, were never reformed. My office was broken into 2 years ago in the summer, and it was by, people looking for small change in money. But they did enormous damage to the building.
And just to go back to what, Jeff, you were saying earlier, in terms of setting standards that criminals will respect, knowing that they're going to serve X amount of time for X offense, is in part why you want to try and keep the wall there for truth in sentencing.
I think the predictability of the sentence, the predictability of the system, the predictability of the punishment is important for everyone, not just the in terms of deterrence. But I'd like to interject, because I think that when we talk about prosecutor-driven policies, I want to at least say prosecutors also drive other types of programs that go towards more what Mike and Luke were looking for, and including innovative approaches to dealing with people who have already committed crimes and have drug problems. And prosecutors are involved in drug treatment courts. We run diversion programs. And in Michigan, we participate in community corrections programs where we try to use options other than prison. I think sometimes we get into this discussion, and I'm certain at least your listeners are not all aware of what percentage of criminals go to prison. And I'm talking about all criminals. First of all, the legislature makes the classification, and minor crimes are called misdemeanors. And I'd like to go into what prison commitment rate really is in Michigan and probably across the country.
We'll pick that up when we come back. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, is the state budget crisis as you see it driving the right sort of changes in the way that the prisons of America are being run? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
Listening to The Connection from National Public Radio, I'm Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. This hour about prisons and the news that we keep hearing about prisons being closed and inmates being released early and changes in the legislation that affects sentencing, in part as a response to the state budget crisis that legislators are looking at now. Nick Turner's with us. He's Director of National Programs at the Vera Institute of Justice. And Jeff Sauter is Eaton County Prosecutor in East Lansing, or in Charlotte, Michigan. He's joining us from there. And Jeff, I want to let you just sort of finish up the point you were making about who actually goes to jail.
Right. Thanks. I think there's a misconception that all felons go to prison or that a significant percentage of them start there. That's not true. In Michigan, the prison commitment rate is 25%. That means that only that 3 out of 4 felons ever go to prison. That's not just on the original sentence. Many felons are initially given opportunities on probation, including treatment programs and other types of supervision within the community, and are only sent to prison after a probation violation or repeated probation violations. And the total is only 25%. So the conception that we send everybody to prison automatically or mandatorily doesn't fit the facts, that judges do use other options. And that 3 out of 4 felons, at least in Michigan, and Nick probably knows if this is consistent across the country, ever go to prison or never go to prison.
Dick, let me jump in for just a second. I mean, I think that Jeff is both right and wrong. I mean, and just to sort of put it in a larger context, I mean, this nation relies on prison and incarceration as a mode of punishment of criminals in a way that no other nations in the world do. And just to give you an example, about 700 people per every 100,000 in this country are incarcerated. And you compare that with with Europe, and the highest rate of incarceration is 193 per 100,000. So we're more than we incarcerate more than three times more than Portugal does. Now, we're not Portugal, that's clear. We have different crime rates, and we have a different culture here, and that all goes into the mix. But what you can say about the American criminal justice system generally is that when judges and prosecutors have to think about the range of sentencing options for offenders, they typically have, for the most part, probation, jail, and prison, and there's not a lot in between. Michigan has more than many other states, and Jeff can probably speak to some of those things, but there often aren't a lot of other options, and probation is woefully under-resourced.
You said jail or prison. I assume you mean short-term versus long-term incarceration?
Yes. Well, right. Yeah. I mean, same thing, essentially. But
they're all
jail
bars
is,
to me.
Exactly. Right. So the point is that we don't – you could think of – And a number of states have managed to do this, a range of other sanctions that are tough and also aid in rehabilitation but are in the community, but we don't invest money in them. We invest money in secure facilities. Mm-hmm. And again, Michigan is probably a decent example of a state that tries to actually invest in some of the other alternatives, which are things like day reporting centers where you send an offender, they have to go there from 9 to 5. They get drug treatment. They get vocational training. They have to be there, and then they go home, and they have to report back the next day. Or electronic home monitoring or intensive supervision. Or fines. And there are a range of ways in which you can respond and punish an offender but also not spend $25,000 to put them behind bars.
Let's go
and
along.
This country does not do that well.
I'd like to hear from Oliver, who's standing by in Boston. Oliver, are you there?
Yeah.
Hi, go ahead.
All right. It just occurs to me that we've heard several times that the goal of the penal system is not really rehabilitation. And the lengths of sentences are not created by anything other than societal pressure through legislation. So when the societal pressure changes due to money constraints, mm-hmm. then there's nothing really wrong with shortening the sentences of people that aren't really rehabilitated anyway. So if we let them out early, it's not really going to create any more danger to society than just maybe a slight acceleration of process, but not anything significant.
So you're saying that if it's done properly, the kind of early release that we were talking about earlier in the program is a reasonable way of a state perhaps saving some money.
Right. Obviously, they're not letting out rapists and murderers. They're letting out nonviolent drug offenders.
Jeff?
Well, I'm not so sure about that, Oliver. When you say nonviolent, are you comfortable that there is a universal definition of what's included in that? Because I'm not. In my county, I had a woman murdered in her own home by a man who had committed a previous murder. He was let out early. He committed an armed robbery. He was let out early again. Had he served the minimum sentence on his initial crime of murder, setting aside the armed robbery, she would still be alive.
So I guess my point would be more that the only thing that would have changed in that situation is that the second armed robbery or murder that he committed would have been pushed back a little bit. That's an extreme case with the murder, but it was in the mid-90s,
Oliver. It wasn't that long ago in Michigan. So when people talk about we're only going to let out nonviolent offenders.
But what about Oliver's point that the person was going to commit the offense whether they served, you know, three-quarters of the sentence or the whole sentence?
But I thought the question was, does it impact on public safety?
Well, it does. I'm saying it does either way.
Well, if I can jump in, I mean, the point is that all of our policies and decisions we make impact on public safety. And the danger with your logic, Jeff, is that you want to create public policy on the basis of an anecdote. And that's part of the problem that has existed in the politics of criminal justice for a long time. And you look at three strikes in California, and that was driven entirely by the Polly Klass murder. So what we have to do is figure out how to have a sophisticated conversation about it, know that we take risks in certain policies, and acknowledge that, you know, you might, for instance, you know, you've repealed drug mandatory minimums. You might have a drug offender who ends up going to probation in a month from now, and no one can predict this, and he or she ends up murdering someone. And
right,
so then
we,
there will
we
be
support.
A clamor to repeal the policies that you just that you and to bring back the mandatories and elected officials.
I'm not so sure on that, Nick, because I think that we're talking about different types of policies. We support smart sentencing. I don't support smart sentencing. And that's why we agreed. We worked with the elimination of the mandatory minimums because
I'm sorry, Jay, I think what is smart sentencing? I just don't know what the term refers to.
Well, I think when I say I don't support three strikes, it's because three strikes takes away the judge's discretion and the third offense to fit the punishment to the crime and the offender.
So discretion
and same with mandatory minimums. You have made an objective, broad decision in advance for a class of crimes, and so you have eliminated that judicial discretion. So smart sentencing is restoring the discretion both to the public officials, the prosecutor, and the judge to make those determinations.
Okay,
and those two are that way. Truth in sentencing, I don't think fits in with those two at all.
Let's move along if we can. Oliver, thanks for your call to Jedburgh, South Carolina. Bill's on the line. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
My take on this is when there is a budget crunch and somebody's, you know, they've got to save money some way or another, what they do is they do something which will encourage us to pay more taxes, such as turning the criminals loose. Now, I live within 10 miles of two correctional facilities. I am not in the least concerned about the Republican Guard from Iraq marching through Jedburgh, South Carolina, but I would be very concerned if some of the folks that are serving time were turned loose early.
Are they talking about doing that in those prisons?
Well, that's what you're talking about.
No, I'm just wondering if in South Carolina it's something that is being considered, whether or not you've heard anything about that.
Actually, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, Nick, what about this, the idea that the legislators simply use the image of a bunch of guys in orange pajamas rampaging through Jedburgh as a way of getting people to pay higher taxes?
Well, that's a problem, and I'm not sure if that would actually work, because what happens is that the pressures that legislators are feeling right now are from constituents who want them to fund education, want them to fund healthcare, and so on. And I think what they're experiencing now is a crunch. They don't have enough money to pay for everything, mm-hmm. and they're trying to pay for things that people want. And the public right now, you know, Jed perhaps is actually not an exception to it, but the public is now arguing more for sort of more sensible sentencing policies and an approach to criminal justice and trying to pay attention to fiscal matters. I understand why anybody would be concerned about people being released, but what Jed should know is that, you know, releasing them early, they're going to come out anyway. Unless we give everyone life terms, they're coming back out. Jeff's point about undermining the integrity and honesty of a system is a really good point, and that's why I would have trouble endorsing something like what the Kentucky governor did, because it just ruins people's confidence in the system. But people are coming out; there's no denying it. If voters want to pay more taxes to lock everyone up for their lifetimes, then we don't have to worry about it. But that's not going to happen.
Jeff, let me just put you sort of in front of an audience in Michigan that's saying, you know, what should we be doing? How much should we be spending on prisons? So, you know, some of the research says that, you know, incarcerating mothers costs $50,000-$60,000 a year. Maybe we should do something different about them. Incarcerating old people, and we're getting an increase in the age of the population in prisons is more expensive because of medication and hospital care. Can you make a case that the sort of sentencing policy needs to be reviewed with all that in mind?
I have no problem with a review of the prison policy or the commitment policy, but I think we need to keep in mind that these decisions right now are made by locally elected judges who make a determination based on the offense and the offender.
But that's a good thing, right? I mean, we're not saying that we should have that imposed from somewhere else, right?
I would object to it, and I would object to the type of mandatory type of determination that would either preclude incarceration or require it.
So
either way.
Do you think that you're going to have this early release debate happening in Michigan shortly?
I think the debate is a certainty.
And you think it's going to happen?
Yes.
No.
Do I think that early release may actually take place? Well, I sure hope it does not.
Nick, how, sitting from your perspective at the Vera Institute, when it's always money that makes the determination about what's the right policy, how do you get the legislators and the lawmakers to say, right, let's just try and put the dollar sign aside at least long enough to say, what's the right prison system we should have?
I mean, it's really very difficult to do because it's a long-term solution when they're often looking for short-term solutions. And so what you really have to help them do is sort of look beyond the current budget year and try to endorse. And it often means getting prosecutors to work with them to try to endorse broad systemic reform where they would say over the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to create a commission that's going to develop sensible policies that takes into consideration fiscal ramifications and tries to reserve prison beds for violent and habitual offenders and tries to impose truth in sentencing, but tries to do smarter, less expensive things with nonviolent offenders.
And then like Constance was saying from Raleigh, you need legislators who are willing to say, right, that's a good policy, we're going to pay for it, regardless of how and where we get the money. We're not going to release people early on this year and put more away the next.
Right, and it takes real political courage. And my sense is, listening to legislators and prosecutors like Jeff around the country, is that courage is starting to bubble up. That we're shifting in terms of how we think about this. But I think you do need to get away from the sort of panicked, desperate responses that we've been seeing recently.
Nick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Nick Turner, Director of National Programs at the Vera Institute of Justice in New York City. Jeff Sauter, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Jeff is the prosecutor in Eaton County, Michigan. Connection listeners, you can continue this conversation on our website. You'll find our forum pages there, one button click away. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Up next on The Connection, if things...